Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we do our favorite thing every week, talk a little politics. Lots going on out there on the world, Brandon. Let's start, as we have been known to, we're talking global, talking international. Guess what? No more North Korea summit. What happened?
The summit is off, Jay. I just want to preface this by saying that the president did not have a good week, right? He's misspelled his wife's name in a tweet. It was discovered that he was using an unsecure phone for somebody who complains about, like, leaks.
Yeah, this exactly. And didn't care that he was using an unsecured phone.
And just to cap it all off, there's a sinkhole on the north lawn of the White House. So maybe this is a symptom of, maybe it's a symbol of the way that things are going, especially foreign policy-wise, like you said. The summit has been canceled, Jay. I know that you were a huge collector of these coins that they issue for these kinds of occasions, right? So you're going to have to hold on to that because it's going to be worth a lot of money when there's a peace agreement, but that might be a long way off.
Yeah, my question is, what are we going to do now with this Nobel Prize? Because I had it all ready to go.
He locked it down.
But what, you know, we've had so much winning. I'm sure he'll win something else, right?
He'll win it for something else. It's fine.
Exactly.
No, there's all details, though.
But in all seriousness, the summit is off. It sort of just happened. The president put out a statement via Twitter, shockingly.
Yep.
In the letter, they sort of detailed, go through the tremendous military prowess of the U.S. and that North Korea is making a mistake. And ironically, this is happening the day North Korea is dismantling their one testing facility in North Korea.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. I think that putting the president in the center of this is a real risk. I think that, frankly, this is probably their tacit realization that this is not going to go well, that they didn't have a real kind of fortified plan as to how to deal with the long-term implications of the denuclearization and maybe the trade-offs that would come with that. So to me, this is just a symptom of the fact that they really weren't prepared for this. And really, there is no plan. So I'm not that surprised it's not going to happen. But the problem for the president politically is that so much was promised, right? And now so little is delivered.
I mean, you build up expectations. We've talked about this before, you know, geopolitics and state-by-state negotiations on complex issues is not a condo lease on the Upper East Side. It's just not. And so this notion of that you can kind of wing it through personal diplomacy, through bravado, it just doesn't work. North Korea is one of the most unpredictable actors in the world. And so this idea that you could get them to suddenly do something and they were going to reverse, you know, 30, 40 years of policy, plus you had issues with, you know, the president having to reassure Kim Jong-un that he's not going to be deposed,
right?
References to Libya by the vice president. None of it made any sense. None of it was a good idea.
Yeah, I think the strategy was really undeveloped from the start. And so it's not surprising this happened, but I think it does hurt him politically. And for what went from possibly a big win to now a kind of big flat nothing, I think it's a real problem for them.
Well, Brandon, the president is engaging with a new enemy, and it seems to be the FBI.
So, the enemy is us, right?
Exactly. So the president has seemed to have alleged that the FBI inserted or embedded a covert operative into his campaign, and he wants the Justice Department to immediately investigate this. But this is from 2016. Is there any truth to this, or is this an attempt of the president to kind of sort of change direction on the Russia investigation?
Well, apparently there's no actual evidence of this. That's not to say it's not happening. But what I think for sure is happening and is a problem is that the president summoned three of the U.S.'s top law enforcement agencies, including the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, to the White House to demand that DOJ investigate this. To me, Jay, this is a real problem. This is a definite crossing of a line that protects the independence of the judiciary, right? I know these people work for the White House in some loose sense, right? They work for the executive branch, but more than that, they work for the system. And if it's the case that those separation of powers aren't well respected, then it's going to be a major problem. So to me, the fulcrum is that the system is not separated anymore. And that is a real breakdown in terms of how this operates. So these are norms more than kind of well-settled law as to what the president can kind of demand from DOJ. But at the very least, these are entrenched in important parts of the system.
My read on it is it's really just another attempt by the president to essentially sort of discredit the underlying investigation that the FBI is doing in terms of the Russiagate. Mm. I think he sees this as a way to sort of chum the water, so to speak, and create some question about the independence and about the underlying biases of the FBI, which, to your larger point, is incredibly dangerous. The one thing that we have to believe in is our judicial system, is the integrity of due process and integrity of the overall investigative powers of government. Because if that starts breaking down, people start questioning whether or not things are being done for political motivation or to enforce the law, then I think we're going to have real problems going forward.
Yeah. Speaking of problems, there are some definite issues with respect to the ability of the Republicans to deliver on things that even Republicans want, like the farm bill. What happened there?
Yeah, huge loss for Speaker Ryan. This is, again, another example of the revolt from the right combined with some friendship from the left. You had the Freedom Caucus and some liberal Democrats that essentially came together to oppose the farm bill. This is a really large, massive bill to deal with not just farm subsidies, but the way the food stamp program is administered. But it was supposed to be a signature win in Trump country.
Yep.
At a time that was desperately needed. Speaker Ryan strongly supported the bill, but they weren't able to actually get it to pass.
Yeah, it's ironic that something like a farm bill, which most people don't think about, has led to the undoing and stampeding of the Freedom Caucus. But this is part of a larger story here that is about immigration as well as the other issues they disagree on. There's been consensus on the farm bill since the 1980s, right? Republicans have almost always supported these things. There's always been consensus on it. But this has been undone by the Freedom Caucus, who have serious differences with leadership. This is the second Speaker of the House who essentially has been kind of kicked in the pants on the way out of the door, and it's perhaps not surprising that they can't get anything done.
And the weird thing about it is it wasn't even directly about the farm bill. It was related to immigration and whether or not an immigration bill was going to move forward. And so it creates this weird dynamic where, again, the inability of the Republican Party to sort of come together and govern and put out a few signature wins. We've talked about this before. They've got the tax bill. The economy is strong. They're not getting the kind of credit that they wanted out of that tax bill. And they're not even getting as much credit as they ought to out of a pretty robust economy right now. So it's created some really interesting issues, and it's resonated around the country in some of these primaries we've seen, Brandon.
Yeah, it's going to pass, but it's definitely going to be a more of a slog than they thought. And it underscores the fact that it's just difficult to get things done. And even on issues that are generally consensus building, you definitely see that there's divisions. The divisions aren't just within the Republican caucus. They're also between the parties, right? And the primaries we had this week all around the country, including Texas, which we'll talk about, have shown that.
Right. So we had a few national primaries. We'll talk big, then we'll go down into Texas. A couple things that caught my eye. Obviously, again, you've talked about this on previous shows. The year of the woman continues in terms of Democratic Party politics. We had the battle of the Stacys for Georgia. Stacey Evans, Stacey Abrams, both running to be the Democratic nominee for governor in Georgia. Stacey Abrams, who's the former minority leader of the Georgia House, first African-American woman to ever be nominated for governor of any state anywhere in history. It's sort of a momentous nomination.
It is, and it underscores, like you say, the fact that you've definitely found the Democrats moving away from a kind of sort of centrist talk and are appealing to more left-leaning voters. We've seen that to some degree in Texas, too, which we'll talk about. But I think things like gun control, financial aid for lower-income families, even decriminalization of marijuana, these have been things that were kind of central to what Democrats were talking about. To me, the one highlight was a woman named Amy McGrath, who is running for Kentucky's 6th congressional district. She beat the mayor of Lexington in that primary. Her ads are really good. They are really good. So if you haven't yet, pause the podcast, go Google search them. They're really funny.
They're great. She's a former fighter pilot, right?
Yeah, she's a former fighter pilot, and I think is a kind of crop of Democrat that is going to be successful in these kinds of races. She's running for a seat that is a +9 Republican district. It's something that Trump won by about 23 points, so it's going to be a major uphill battle, but there's going to be a lot of money poured into this, and I think it's going to be a really interesting race.
Yeah, she's in line sort of with that Connor Lamb South, so she's really much more of a kind of moderate Democrat and kind of fits the dynamics of that particular district, as we said, sort of a combat veteran, really interesting candidate with some great commercials, as you said.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of commercials, actually, for the governor's race on the Republican side of things, there was an interesting battle between Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle and Secretary of State Brian Kemp. That ad is hilarious, too. It features, in this case, Casey Cagle holding a firearm next to a young man who is interested in dating his daughter.
That's right.
I mean, it is definitely in your face, but it has a kind of clever way of showing that he's going to be a kind of politically incorrect candidate. To me, it suggests even more so that the parties are going in such different directions.
Oh, right? Yeah. And his opponent had a similarly provocative ad where he's driving around in a pickup where he, to use his language, rounding up illegal immigrants. So, yeah, you definitely are not seeing sort of a moderate versus conservative in that Republican primary.
Right.
So it's going to set up a really sharp contrast in Georgia and one that I think is going to garner some national attention. Well, what's garnered a lot of attention nationally and locally here in Texas, and especially in the Houston area where we are, has just been the awful tragedy that happened in Santa Fe High School just outside of Houston. 10 students and teachers were gunned down in a fatal shooting. 10 or 11 individuals, I think, were hurt as well. It sparked a lot of conversation about what to do with sort of mass shooting violence in general, how to handle it. Governor Abbott has now convened a roundtable that started. Brandon, what's your take on this in terms of, obviously, we are all sort of numb from this tragedy, but what's your take on what you think is going to happen moving forward? Are we going to see changes to law? What are the implications here?
Yeah, you're right. This once again has happened, and I read a statistic that was shocking. It was that 2018 has been deadlier for school children than for service members abroad. That's shocking. And what I think this suggests is that, and Governor Abbott's response to it suggests, is that this is an issue that cannot be ignored. It is also an issue that Governor Abbott recognizes could be trouble for Republicans. You're not going to find a lot of consensus on these issues, and the governor has put out some suggestions and has was in fact in line to do this anyway, even before this happened. And the roundtables have suggested things like, you know, parent training with respect to firearms, early intervention from individuals who may have mental health issues in schools. There are some other issues as well, but I think this is a recognition that this is political trouble for the governor. The fact that he went in a different direction than Dan Patrick did to me is also interesting, right? Dan Patrick said basically, like, I want to minimize it, but he said basically video games are to blame, right? That the kind of culture of violence that devalues life is the problem, and that we should make schools more limited and sort of hardened, as they say, fewer windows, fewer doors to let people in. So they went in different directions. I think it reflects the fact that they had different positions, as well as politically, they have a very different kind of base.
Well, shifting gears a bit, Brandon, we had a big court ruling that came out that looks like it might have a really positive impact here in Texas. District Judge Orlando Garcia came out with a ruling that essentially has said that Texas has been in violation of the Motor Voter Act, which effectively says that when you are getting your driver's license or renewing your driver's license, you need to be able to have the opportunity to re-register to vote. Well, Texas hasn't been doing that. When you've been getting your licenses renewed, you haven't been afforded that opportunity, and the court is saying, you know what, we need online registration. That's going to solve this problem, and it's the court's now appealing it, the state is now appealing it.
Yeah, that's why I think that last part you said, that I don't know that it'll go anywhere. It would be great to have more of this, I think. That would definitely bring more people in the process, but it's going to be hard to move this rock, right? The sort of current leadership is fairly committed to this process, and I suspect that, like voter ID, there's probably a way around it, right? If you can sort of manufacture some kind of a solution, my guess is that's going to work. I don't think we're going to be voting or re-registering online anytime soon. But it definitely is the case that something like this in the future has to be put on the agenda.
Yeah, I think you're going to be forced to have to just comply, and that'll solve the problem as opposed to that. But speaking of complying, you know, every now and then we come across politicians that just say the darndest things, right? Well, down in the valley, in a Democratic runoff for county judge, one of the candidates, Rudy Bowles, pretty much called out the chair of the Maverick County Democratic Party and threatened to send a Mexican drug cartel against him. What happened?
Right. So this candidate, who didn't win, by the way, has been accused of leaving the county chairman a voicemail that essentially demands, I think he was demanding like a list of precinct chairs, and that if he didn't get it, he was going to call, quote, the damn Zetas if he didn't get his way. So, I mean, I definitely have my frustrations, and I know we all get to that point where things are heated, but this may have broken the decorum that we'd like to see in the political scene, right?
Yeah, the party chair called out the cops, and it's, in fact, just so our audience knows, that's a terroristic threat.
Wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's a misdemeanor here in Texas, and so can get you in a lot of trouble. So by all means, do not threaten to call a Mexican drug cartel to come get someone you do not like. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the big election runoffs we just had here in Texas, kind of break some of them down and tell you why it's so important.
All right, Jay. Well, the runoff has come and gone. Texas has voted. We've cast our ballots for individuals who are in the runoff. Some interesting things happened, I think, both up and down the ballot. Let's talk first about just general turnout. What were your impressions?
Yeah, you know, general turnout was not good. Not good at all.
No, I like to be very diplomatic.
Yeah,
Jay.
So we had about 2.8% statewide among Democrats, similar amount among Republicans. So basically a little under 5% turned out statewide. So it wasn't very good. Now, what was the big driver in this race was not the top of the ticket races. It was a little bit different. We had 10 to 12 runoffs with respective parties that were driving this. And these runoffs were at congressional districts.
Yeah.
We had the highest number of Democratic primary runoffs for congressional districts that we've ever had. So you seemed like you were getting a lot of sort of attention from a more localized grassroots level.
Yeah, you'd think that would spike turnout, but it didn't.
And right.
To me, the most important thing wasn't just the fact that not that many people voted, but the fall off from the number of people who voted in the primary, right? 1.1 million Democrats voted in the primary. Only about 600,000 voters participated in the runoff. So you're talking about like a significant drop, right? So it's not the fall that will kill you, but certainly the abrupt stop at the end will kill you. And for Democrats hoping for a blue wave, I just don't know what to make of this.
Well, I will say this. I think it was an equal opportunity problem because Republicans had the same thing. Now the difference is Republicans did not have a top of the ticket race at all. They had no runoffs at all at state level, but they had some key congressional districts, you know, certainly in Houston and in San Antonio that drove out some turnout. But by and large, they didn't have the same effect the Democrats did. We know that at the top of the ticket for Democrats, Lupe Valdez ended up beating Andrew White by much closer margin than that was existent in the first round. But in large part, both candidates didn't do much in terms of spending money to generate turnout. They had very little in terms of statewide operations. So
that's a real problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
For both
of them. Not really unexpected, but you're right. Not a great sign.
Look, I mean, for Democrats, right, you only had 430,000 people coming to vote. The Republicans had about 408. For Republicans, I think you're right, that was pretty small, but this is still the third highest total for Republican runoff in history. So they're making do, right? And they didn't have a statewide office to vote for. So I think that's one thing that is possibly, you know, disconcerting for Democrats. The other is that Lupe Valdez received the fewest votes of any Democratic gubernatorial nominee in a runoff in Texas history. And she received fewer votes than in the Democratic runoff, then all but two of the gubernatorial candidates who lost their runoff races. So her vote totals, even among Democrats, are pretty low. Why are people not inspired by this governor's race, Jay?
Well, two things. One, I think there's a general view that the race is a very hard get for Democrats.
Yeah, like November is.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg Abbott continues to be very popular. And I think just from in terms of just interest on the Democratic side, it's just not there because they recognize that. But the other part is neither Andrew White nor Lupe Valdez, in particular Lupe Valdez, did much in terms of inspiring people to come out and vote. She ran essentially no campaign. It's one of the most astounding things I've ever seen for a major party nominee. They spent basically less than a state representative would for a major candidate. Just a few hundred thousand dollars for a statewide campaign in Texas is just unheard of. It really relied on the strength of her, the constituent support that she's had in the past in the Dallas area, the affinity voting that you've seen in the past with Spanish surname candidates, and some of the interest group support that she had from folks like AFL-CIO and Planned Parenthood. Obviously, it was enough to get her through the runoff, but I don't see where this goes anywhere. She hasn't done. I mean, she's been essentially lambasted by every newspaper in the state as effectively sort of ill-prepared to run for governor or be governor. So there's a lot of ground to make up for her.
I'll give her credit. The last couple of weeks, she definitely turned it up a notch. I think what she lacked in kind of policy knowledge, she definitely made up for in passion. She was very energetic. And that, I think, is going to be helpful. But at the end of the day, I think you're right. It's going to be tough for her to, you know, kind of be on a stage and debate policy with somebody like Greg Abbott, who, you know, has not only held multiple offices in Texas, but also understands that process pretty well. And also politically, got what he wanted, right? I mean, yeah, we can't let this go. Like, the governor said he wanted to run against her, basically, right? He was running ads and spending more money on that campaign than she was to define her. And I think that's going to be a major issue for them to have to overcome. She's already $40 million in the hole, right? Greg Abbott's got a $41 million war chest. Valdez has raised practically nothing. How is she going to be able to get out from under this and define herself to voters before Greg Abbott does?
Yeah, he wanted to, you know, he wanted to run a race on abortion, and he wanted to run a race on sanctuary cities and immigration. Essentially, Lupa Valdez was the candidate for him.
Yeah.
And so he recognized that, and so he's defining the agenda. He knew that it would be a different race with white, so this, it made more sense for him. Not that dissimilar from what happened 4 years ago with Wendy Davis. I think it's just a hard, hard slog for her to even really be competitive in this, unless some dynamics change in this race, and we'll see. But Brandon, let's shift gears. Let's talk local here, and we'll talk about Harris County. That's where we are. We had a big race in CD7, Congressional District 7. Lizzie Pannell Fletcher. That was supposed to be a close race, but somebody forgot to tell Lizzie Fletcher because she crushed Laura Moser, who is a fine candidate, but you have to call a crushing win a crushing win.
Right. You got to call it like you see it. I mean, you and I had texted that night. I suggested that Fletcher would win by a comfortable margin and that Crenshaw would also lose by a small margin. So, I don't know. I had a home run and a strikeout, right? Clearly, Fletcher wins. I think she was definitely sort of the establishment choice from the start. My worry is that you're going to find that that's not going to be able to heal. Those wounds won't heal. For the Crenshaw race, I was frankly surprised, but the grassroots effort to support Crenshaw came out in full force. And I think, like actually in other cases, we saw conservatives come up big, not just Dan Crenshaw, but Chip Roy in CD21,
yeah.
Michael Clough down in CD27. There's also an anti-incumbent mood, right, which saw Representative Scott Cosper in HD54, who lost. Also, Renee Olvera, who we should talk about, is a Democrat who was caught with a DUI,
right.
Also lost. But there was definitely an anti-incumbent mood. And I think that the fact that Roberts was in office probably made people look at him as somebody who was part of the problem, even though he hadn't been there that long.
Yeah, I see it as kind of a weird little mirror image. In CD2, Crenshaw won, grassroots support, a lot of sort of anti-Washington, kind of a different kind of candidate. On the Democratic side, I thought it was a conscious effort by local Democrats to say, we want somebody that we think can win.
Mm-hmm.
Lizzie Fletcher was every bit the progressive that Laura Moser was, but she just did it sort of in a more businesslike, lawyerly
mm-hmm.
fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be interesting.
We don't
have
enough lawyers in Congress.
Right? I know. There's a shortage of that, I think. but I think she's going to be a more competitive candidate for that reason alone,
yeah.
Stylistically. And I think it'll be interesting to see that still preserves that as a potential race. CD2, Todd Litton on the Democratic side is a great candidate. But Dan Crenshaw seems to be kind of a force of nature. That race was very negative, and Crenshaw won by almost an equally large margin as Fletcher did. But let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll tell you why all these races are so important.
So, Jay, you know, we had a small turnout. We had a few races on the ballot, but I think it can tell us a lot about what's happening in the state. So what's your take on what happened during the runoff and why it's important?
Well, I think two things. One, turnout. It's still low. We don't see anything out there that's going to excite folks. Certainly not at the top of the ticket. Maybe some congressional races. That's one. Two, we've got races in play. Some of these congressional races, whether it's here in Houston, in San Antonio, in Dallas, Democrats got their best and most electable candidates in play. So in some of these key races, you're going to see some interesting things potentially happen that could affect the House.
Yeah. I think the one takeaway I think that's the most important is don't attack a Navy SEAL. They don't go down. So the Crenshaw race, I think, was compelling because that kind of candidate, I think, is going to be much more common in the future for Republicans and for Democrats. But I think that that grassroots support was something that everybody could look to as something that they need to be able to search for. On the governor's race, I wonder if this is still a kind of ambiguous outcome in terms of the ideology of the party, right? It was so close. I don't think you could necessarily say that the party, the members, the voters rejected sort of the more liberal approach for the more conservative approach, but it's clear that the party is trending in a more liberal direction. I think in some ways that's good for the party. It activates people who are more progressive, younger people. The fact that Lupe Valdez is a Latina, the fact that she's a lesbian, also I think is going to excite some of the Democrats. But like you say, turnout's going to be a major problem. She's got big work to do in places like Houston and Fort Bend, where she did not win very big, where White did really well. Beyond Dallas and San Antonio, her message just isn't penetrating. So there's a lot of work for Democrats, but the opportunity is there because we're going to have a major change, I think, come November.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks as always to our executive producer, Don Geraci, who would always pick us on a runoff, to our web team, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the stable genius Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.